okay, enough. Okay, so welcome to another talk, again, on the meditation. And yesterday I was going through the disappearing act, where by learning how to be still, then the senses tend to disappear. So in other words, that things, because they're still, they're not bothering us, and when they're not bothering us, it means that they vanish to our perception, and then we see what's left. And there is one of the similes, trying to find similes which make sense to people, was the simile of the emperor. And this emperor was a very powerful being. And he influenced many people's lives. And the problem was that no one knew who the emperor was. Because every time the emperor appeared in public, was always covered head to toe with the five different garments. First of all, there was the boots, which covered the feet and went way past his knees up to the thighs, and had trousers or which overlapped the top of the boots and went way up above above the waist. And on top of the jacket, trousers, there was a jacket, a very thick jacket, which overlapped the top of the trousers, with sleeves going down to the wrists and a high neck. And overlapping the edge of the jacket, the sleeves, there were these big gloves, leather gloves, which overlapped the sleeves of the jacket. On top of everything, there was a helmet. And the helmet overlapped the top of the jacket and covered the whole face. So much so that no one knew who that emperor was. And already, I was very careful to make sure that when I described the five pieces of clothing covering the emperor, I never mentioned a him or a her or an it. Because no one knew whether it was male or female or something else. They didn't know if the emperor was young or old, African, Asian, Chinese. No one knew who the emperor was because it was always covered. And so when you don't know what a powerful emperor is, sometimes we're always curious to try and find out. What is this emperor which runs the whole empire and has so much influence in ordinary people's lives? So this is just like this body and mind of ours. And we have the insight, the understanding, the intuition that this mind is like an emperor. Whatever the mind thinks and does, it can be negative, it can be positive. And what the mind does affects the whole of the rest of the body and our lives. So we want to find out, what is this emperor? The mind. So the only way we can find out is to take off the five pieces of clothing. Remove the boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves and the helmet, to see what is wearing this five pieces of clothing. And then you can find out what the emperor is, what this mind is. And of course, that simile, take off the five senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, just reduce them, calm them down until they vanish, so you see what's underneath all of this. What is this sixth sense? The mind. People have all sorts of ideas about the mind and what it actually is, and I will now give a couple of demonstrations which you're welcome to use in any area of your life when people say, this mind, what actually is it? So, first of all, I want you to be honest, and if you are happy, put up your right hand. If you are miserable, put up your left hand. No one ever does that because, okay, yeah, you did, whee! Just one. If you're really happy, happier than usual, or less than happy than usual. Left hand, less than happy. Right hand, if you're more than happy. Okay, hand up now. Keep your hand up. Now with whatever hand you're holding up, with your index finger, please point to that happiness for me. Where's it located? What do you say? Right, that's recorded on the camera. I'll look at that later on. Yeah. So where is the happiness located? It's a little party trick where you can do in conferences, because people wave their hands all over the place. They can't agree where the happiness is located, but they agree that they're happy. They agree that they're miserable. The misery exists. Like being grumpy, it exists. You're fed up, you're tired, you're in love, you're really angry. Those are things which you know exist. But where are they located? And the problem is because you can't point to them sort of in your body, because they don't really exist in the body. They exist in the realm of the mind. And when we want to say, what is a mind, use the simile, what's a garden? Is this a garden here? No, there's no plants or flowers, no real ones. You know it's a garden by its content. You have the lawns, the flowers, the bushes, the fountains or whatever. That a garden is known by its contents, what actually is in this garden. And so we know what a mind is by its contents. It's where happiness, misery, anxiety, fear, peace, bliss, where you find those plants, those shrubs, that's where the mind is. So first of all, you know the mind by its contents. But so, in this world of space, where does it live in this universe? And this is that simile I probably said it the first day. When it gets to the fifth or sixth day, it talks so much. I don't know what I said on the first day, but this was a beautiful, I think I did say about the daughter of one of my best friends who eventually went to Oxford, PhD in biochemistry. And she was the one when asked in grade one at school in England by her teacher. I think I told her somewhere else. She was asked by a teacher in grade one, what is the biggest thing in the world? What's the biggest thing in the world? This was a 5 or 6 year old. One kid put up their hand. My daddy is the biggest thing in the world. No, an elephant is the biggest thing in the world. They've just been to the zoo. No, a mountain is the biggest thing in the world. And this is when the daughter of my friend, only 5, 6 years of age, she said, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. This is a great thing with kids. They think, they do literally think outside the box. They haven't been taught how to think. In other words, their exploratory mind has yet to be trained to actually to see things in the normal way. So innovation is great when you get kids speaking. So my eye's the biggest thing in the world. What the heck do you mean? Well, she said, my eye can see her father. It can see an elephant, it can see a mountain, and so much more. If all of that can fit inside my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. That was just such amazing logic. And it shows what actually insight is. It's insight is seeing things from a different angle, a different perspective. It's not working on the old ways of thinking, but seeing things in a different way, which kids are great at doing. And so it was such a wonderful piece of philosophy and logic that I sort of took it that little bit further. I said, you're almost right, because your eye can see so many things in this world. It can see Niagara Falls, it can see the Himalaya Mountains, it can see outer space. But your mind can see all of that. And it can see things you'll never see in the real world, imaginary things. Your mind can hear sounds, real and imaginary. It can smell and taste, and it can feel feelings, maybe things like phantom limbs. You can actually feel sensations in the body, which aren't really, how are they there? and then it has its own area of things like bliss and fear. In fact, everything that can ever be known by you can fit into your mind. So the mind isn't the biggest thing in the world. The world can fit into the mind because it can be known. Everything you can ever know can fit into this mind. That's why you can't locate it in space or anywhere, it's too big. Things fit into your mind. Now that's a very cool piece of logic. And I've thrown it out there to some philosophers and they haven't really been able to come back to refute that piece of logic. All starting from a 5-year-old kid. So anyway, what is the mind? The biggest thing, not in the world, because the world could exist in your mind. So, from there, we're trying to find out what this mind is. So, when these five senses, they're the things which we spend so much time focusing on, to the point that a lot of people have, you know, when I made that joke the other day, lost their mind, thinking it's just a byproduct of a brain. But it's much more than that. And so when we start to look at the mind, the only way you can really understand it is to let the five senses vanish, which is a hard thing to do. But this is the job of meditation. So when the five senses get subdued, then this is what usually happens. Is, you know, to get to that stage, it's very hard just to let go of all the senses just like that. So we do it gradually, like most things. You know, sitting down, not moving, and then things like your hands disappear. And it's such wonderful being a teacher and seeing people having parts of their body disappear one by one and just seeing how scared they are. I still remember this gentleman in Singapore came to me after just a meditation, just with, not a retreat, but just a meditation session before I gave a talk, and afterwards he said, "Ajahn Brah, what happened? I couldn't feel my hands. My hands disappeared." I said, "But they're here now." I said, "Oh yeah, but no, I was sitting there and I couldn't feel my hands. What's going on? Is it some disease? I'm getting some motor neuron disease, or what's happening?" He was so scared. He said, "No, you're perfectly healthy. All it really is just, you know, the perception of your hands is gone." And it was only a small thing, but for him it was just really scary. He was going to a place, you know, where he hadn't been to before, and he was scared because he didn't know what his hands were up to. He couldn't control them because the awareness of them had just been let go while he was looking at something else. Or even sometimes later on when your thoughts disappear. And sometimes people say, it's impossible, because, you know, you have to be thinking. If you're not thinking, you're unconscious. And then little by little, you lead them, little by little, into letting go of your thinking. And of course, the usual little teaching technique, because again, I'm sharing this with you, please use this for other people when you discuss meditation with them and they say, "Oh, it's impossible to think, I'm always thinking." And you say, "No, you're not." I said, "Yes, I am." And then you prove it to them. Very simple exercise. And many of you have done this before. Listen to me carefully with mindfulness as I am speaking. And also remember just the reaction, you know, in your mind as I am speaking. Because you will begin to notice that there are some spaces between my words. In those spaces, what was happening inside your awareness? You were silent. You weren't thinking, because you never knew when I was going to start speaking again. You were paused. How easy it is to be silent. There it was again. So the reason we do this little exercise is so you can actually experience, hey, I can be aware, alive, conscious, and there's no thoughts going on in my mind. There it was again. So what you're doing, you are training yourself to become used to the silent mind, to get to know the silence, not to be afraid of it, not to fill it up, because people don't like silence and emptiness. You can see that, the classic story of somebody climbing to the top of a mountain. What do? First of all, they put a flag on there. I hereby claim this mountain for the kingdom of Bodhinyana. You don't call it kingdom, an abbotdom, a monkdom, or I don't know, a nundom of Dhammasara. I don't know. You put up your flag. If you don't do that, you put up a pile of rocks. And that just starts like that, pile of rocks, a flag, and the next thing you put up there is a restaurant. Or a mobile phone tower or something like that. Why can't you leave things alone? And that pristine wilderness, just leave it. Leave it empty. Just like the same, if you go to Bodhinyana Monastery, which you're most welcome to, just to have a look at, meditate in the hall. It's been a constant battle to be able to keep things out of the hall. People want to put things there. There's all this space, emptiness. Can I put a pot plant there? Can I put a photo there? Can I put another knick-knack on the shrine? Most of the knick-knacks on the shrine, they're there for about a day or two, a week, and then as soon as you go, they go too. We try and keep it simple. They say, oh no, you need something there. And even this hall, we try and keep it as simple as possible, so there's not too many ornaments. What do you need ornaments for when you've got this beautiful space and emptiness? Anyway, so people do not like empty spaces. They think, have a look in that corner. You know that no one sits in that corner. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a little pot plant over there? And maybe sort of a pictures over here of the Buddhist holy places, that'd be really good. And maybe, what else can we do at the top over there? Look, now those bricks over there, can't we sort of get an artist to make a mural of say, the Buddha's Parinibbana or something? And if I didn't stop you here and now, you'll get a collection and you'll make a project to do something like that. Isn't it wonderful to keep it simple and boring? So anyway, there's a constant battle of trying to keep it simple and boring. They want to put something in here. So anyway, that's why simplicity and emptiness, it's always there. We won't pay any attention to it. Just seeing things from a different way. As I think I mentioned one of the first days, you come in this hall. What do you see in this hall when you first come in the door? The people, the floor, the cushions, the teddy bears? Or do you see the emptiness, the space here? Volume-wise, any scientists here, there's more space in this hall than there is things. We don't see that. We see the stuff in the hall. We've been trained of our perception to see things rather than the space between things. The space which surrounds things and embraces things. Sometimes, I remember we were doing one of these conferences and we did a sermon that started off and we were just talking about the oceans which separate people. I said, they don't separate people. It's the oceans which join people. In other words, looking at things in a different way. The oceans of our world which surround the land masses, the home to so many animals, and actually embraces all the bigger thing in which we're little islands of solidity. You know, under this great sort of atmosphere, which again, which embraces all. this little warm blanket of air, just like when you go to bed at night. And above that, this great universe, which hugs us in an embrace of emptiness, all around. Look at it a different way, and then it's what joins us rather than separates us. So little things like that, with the silence between the words, the emptiness between the thoughts, it starts us to look at things in a different way. Not the things, the achievements, the certificates, not those solid things. What joins us? The emptiness. So this day, I don't know if there's any school teachers here, I feel I think I got this from graffiti in Cambridge, where one of the great graffitis there was exams killed by degrees. I think many of you know that. You get a degree and they think you're smart. And, I thought I was so smart when I went to Thailand to stay with Ajahn Chah. I thought I was just really intelligent, and this Ajahn Chah was just so lucky to get a Cambridge graduate as one of his monks. Just how conceited can you be? And then this Ajahn Chah, it was way, 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 way ahead of me when it comes to wisdom. And then he only went to school for 4 years. Grade 4 was all he did. And it was all just really just amazing. And every time I realised just how stupid I was. Anyway, so back to the emptiness and not thinking. When you don't think, sometimes I look at thinking as like talking back to the world. The world is teaching you. It's giving you so much wisdom. But when we talk back at it, oh, this is what it's supposed to be, this is what it means, and this is what it means, and this can't be right, but that can be right, and this is how I heard it somewhere else, and this is how the Abhidharma says, but this is how the Bible says, but this is what the Quran says, and this is what the Torah says. And all the time when the world is speaking to you, you're busy talking. So how on earth can we listen to the teachings of life when we're always talking inside our head? And the classic thing about silence, I haven't said this yet in this retreat, but it was very important to me to understand why be silent and why thinking doesn't really reach the point. It gets you close, you can get rid of a lot of rubbish, a lot of gomayang on the path, but thinking can only take you so far, and then you have to get out of the thinking and then start feeling, knowing, seeing without thought. And that was Lao Tzu, great Taoist master. He had a little like monastery. Every evening he would allow one of his disciples to go on a walk with him. But the walk had to be silent. No talking was allowed. And so this new student got permission to go on a walk with the great master. They walked through the forest up to the hills, and they got to a ridge up in the hills at sunset. And there's this amazing, glorious, beautiful sunset on the horizon. And the young student was so overwhelmed by the beauty of the sunset, he forgot all the rules and said, "Wow, look at that sunset." At which point, Lao Tzu turned around and went back to the monastery, because the student had broken the rule. He said something. And of course, Lao Tzu kept his own rules. So he only sort of taught and reprimanded the student when he was back inside the monastery. And he said, "You can never go on a walk with me ever again." And his friend said, "That's a bit harsh. It's only one sentence. Well, no, surely, you know, you can let him off with just one sentence. It was not that bad. What's the point anyway of banning all speech?" And that was where Lao Tzu said, "When my student said, 'What a beautiful sunset,' he wasn't watching the sunset anymore. He was watching the words. He wasn't aware and mindful of the sunset. He was only aware of the description of the sunset." And I don't know if you get that, but that sort of opened up a huge amount of insight in why we can never really know what's going on when we describe it. You can't catch reality. It's too big for words. It is true that sometimes a great poet can sometimes catch a feeling. It's very rare you see that, but when actually, if you read poetry, And then yet sometimes these great poets, they just nail the emotion and think, wow, that's amazing. It's like, you know, you're with that sunset anymore, you're with grief. Oh, one of my favourite poets, actually used to carry his book around with me when I was a student, was Wilfred Owen, one of the war poets, because he died recently. Oh no, he died recently, he died 100 years ago. His anniversary was recently. And just the subject matter was obviously very moving. You know, the carnage of the trenches in the Second World War, but and he could capture it. So it's every now and again, you know, you can get a word and it actually just is brilliant, but most of the time you don't need the words, and the words get in the way of seeing what's there. And sometimes you can misunderstand those words. Just like one of the last times I went to Dhammasala Monastery. They wanted a quick teaching, the nuns of monastery. And so I said, I've always got to be innovative. Instead of sitting down giving a talk, you can get that from the YouTube or whatever. But I said, oh, I need to go to the toilet. Where can a monk go to the toilet? And so they pointed to the common toilet in the old nun's cottage, as if I needed to know, because I was there, would built that thing. Whether Ajahn Weyama was here, but... And so, I knew exactly where I was going. I said, is that the toilet over there? He said, yeah, you can see the sign there, toilet. So I went to the door and pretended to urinate on the door. I didn't really do it. I do have my limits to how far I can push things. Believe it or not. And I had somebody say, what are you doing? I said, well, you told me that was the toilet. And it actually says it on there, toilet. That's only the sign. The toilet's inside. I said, well, why don't you put toilet inside? Be more specific. That's the whole point. Words, labels are just inaccurate. They're just, you know, you're supposed to interpret them and just say, you know, it's inside. But sometimes these words are as far as we get and we urinate on the label. So anyway, when we can be silent, silence is much, number one, it's for more real. The thoughts are like the second hand opinion, it's not just direct to the reality. And you know that silence is just so much more restful. A word, an idea creates a second word and a third word. But when reality, you just go outside and feel the wind. You know, you feel sort of the cold in the morning. You sip the cup of tea, the warm tea, and just feel it go down your throat. That's real. And that's always so pacifying, so fulfilling. That's one of the reasons why, after a while, we just lose our interest in the words and go to the feeling, which is one of the reasons why don't teach meditation. We encourage you to do meditation and learn for yourself with a direct experience of what it's like when the five senses stop and the thoughts about the five senses stop. You're just there, five senses going, and you're just going to get the mind coming up soon. But the way it actually works is fascinating. That, again, I mentioned yesterday, the breath is dominant as the five senses begin to vanish, because that's always moving. For some time, some people, they're aware of their breath and aware of their heart at the same time, their heartbeat. It's a heartbeat is not a very useful vehicle to take you into the world of the mind. If you try to calm the heartbeat down, really calm it down until it becomes really still and stops, you're in big trouble. So usually you just focus on the breath because that calms down gradually by itself. So first thing here, if it does happen to you, that maybe excitement or fear or the heartbeat is just very strong. Use a simile of, you know, the focusing Google Maps. So in Google Maps you can see two things here. You see the heart and you see the breath. What are you going to center on the screen? And once you center on the screen, then you zoom in on it, and what was on the edge of the screen vanishes as you zoom in. So keep your breath in the center of the map, of the screen, of your mind. You might hear the heart over here, boom, boom, boom. You may hear somebody making a noise, boiling the kettle over here, boom, boom, boom. But you don't center on the distraction. Because if you center on the person who's boiling that kettle at 2 o'clock in the morning, then that kettle just, you literally do zoom in on it, that becomes, occupies your whole mind. If you keep it on the edge, then after a while you don't actually hear the kettle anymore. Because you usually zoom in to what's in the center of your screen. What's the most important? It just happens. What is the most attractive? And then that stays with you. So if you've got the heart beating and you've got the breath, for goodness sake, don't keep the heartbeat in the center of the screen. You can watch the breath, breathing in, breathing out. You can hear the heartbeat, it's over here somewhere. And you still naturally focus in, and then the heartbeat, don't know when it went, but it went. What's in the center is what you watch. So anyway, this is just a simile. And when you're watching the breath, again, happens usually naturally, just watching the breath, and it calms down because you don't need so much oxygen. You're not reacting, you're not doing, you're not thinking, you're not taking. It's okay to take notes now, but not in meditation. And then after a while, the breath gets very smooth and soft. And again, that's when it starts to get delightful. The delight, the beautiful breath, whatever you wish to call it, the pleasure, the piti sukha in Pali, which comes up when you're watching the breath, has got nothing to do with your breathing. It is just how the mind gets its energy, and the breath looks beautiful. If any of you want to check out the Pali, you're watching the breath in and out, you calm the breath, and the chitta sankhara when you get the piti and sukha coming up. It's like a mind-made way of how you watch the breath. So what is happening? You see the breath, you calm it down. It happens naturally, you don't need to do it, it happens by itself until the breath becomes very peaceful. And then you get the joy coming up. This is what the seventh stage of Anapanasati, Chitta Sankhara Pati Sangvedi. This is how the mind watches the breath, delightful and beautiful. And this is what I always call the pivot point of meditation. You start to become joyful. Naturally, you don't force it, it just happens. And that delightful part of meditation, that is when you're just sitting here, just breathing in, breathing out, just happy. You don't want to move. You are fulfilled with the joy of the breath. It's actually not really the breath, it's just the mind just looking at the breath in a joyful way. I've already mentioned this a few times before about the most beautiful baked bean in the morning after a good meditation. When you go outside and the wind is just gorgeous, the birds are just, they sing more sonorous than ever before, and just a little piece of grass is just so incredibly beautiful. And I always say this, William Blake, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, eternity in an hour. That's a sign that the mind is becoming powerful. It can see beautiful in so many different places. And just your mind becomes filled with the joy. It seems really weird to say, aren't we supposed to know suffering? Sometimes you know suffering when it disappears. This is joy, real, happy. So anyway, there you are just watching a delightful breath. Because if it really is truly delightful, you're not doing it, it's just what happens. Because it's delightful, you don't need to put any effort in there at all. I know that some people say, Ajahn Brahm, aren't you supposed to do something in meditation? Well, you can do some effort to start off with. But when you get to delightful breath, please just let it roll. Don't sort of get involved. Just observe. just let the mind just do the rest of the work, because if you get involved, you disturb it again. So you've got delightful breath. You don't need to focus. You don't need to concentrate. In fact, concentration is one of those words. And if I am averse to anything, it's saying meditation is about concentration. It is not. It's about stillness and kindness and joy. Concentration, if this was about concentration, like I often say, then Jhana Grove will be the concentration camp. With all of the bad connotations of what a concentration camp means. So I know that sometimes that people say it's concentration, we're going to a concentration camp today. No way. Instead, if you want to give this place a name to put it in the right context of what we're doing here, don't call it concentration camp, don't call it Jhana Grove Meditation Center, call it Club Med Serpentine. Obviously, it doesn't mean Mediterranean, meditation. Club Meditation Serpentine, Club Med. Because Club Med is where you go on holiday, where you relax and you're supposed to enjoy yourself. But somebody once, I've never been to Club Meditation, I don't know, Club Mediterranean, but some people told me that they show me what they do all day, from the morning to the evening, they're just always doing stuff. And I said, what are you doing that for? It's supposed to be your holiday. And he's just filling every hour, every 5 minutes of the day. And I said, this is crazy stuff. You get up early in the morning, do your yoga and relaxation by the beach, and you finish off at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock with a party on the beach. That will wear you out. I said, actually, that's true. They go on holiday, and they can't wait back to get to work to take a rest. Weirdos. Anyway, but this is learning how to sort of relax with the breath, and it gets very delightful. Because it's delightful, no need to focus. Wandering mind? I'm not wandering anywhere. This is good fun. You know, and sometimes people nudge you, come, it's time for lunch. Get out of the way. You know that sometimes people say to me, just my husband just will not listen to me, especially when there's a football match on. Darling, it's time, there's someone on the phone. Darling, it's time for lunch. Darling, and it's the last minutes of the final of the football. It's not, they're not ignoring you, they just can't hear you. They're in like sport jhana. Sort of speaking. They're totally focused on that. And they're not being mean or nasty, they just cannot hear you at all. Oh, if they can only do that with meditation. And they can. When you get to delightful breath, it's so joyful, sometimes you can't even hear. The senses are turning off. Yay. And then the joy just builds up, just natural, like a snowball effect. Simply because that... five senses not really so concerned, the joy of the breath, which starts to become like a mental phenomenon, a citta sankhara. And then after a while, it gets really, really beautiful. And this is where your meditation really takes off. And it's one thing, just to get you to that point, so you're enjoying the meditation. And don't ever think, you're enjoying it, stop it. Start contemplating, start doing vipassana. You get attached to the joy. Be careful, you're getting attached. That's what you're supposed to do, get attached to the joy. And if you don't believe me, that's in the... I've showed many people this, the Pasadika Sutta. If this is the Buddha talking, he said, if anybody criticizes you, oh, you monks and nuns, you're just attached to pleasure. You should tell those other critics, he said, yeah, that's true, I admit it, I'm attached to pleasure. Hey, well, it's supposed to be religious, you're not supposed to be attached to stuff. So, no, we're attached to the pleasures of deep meditation. And also the pleasures of inspiration, of like service, metta, of like goodness, kindness. Wherever you see that, attached to it. It's joyful. And he said, well, you know, if you get attached to the pleasures of meditation, won't that stop you getting enlightened? And the Buddha replied, anyone who gets attached to the pleasures of the deep meditations, they can only expect one of four results, nothing else, one of these four. Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. If you get attached to the jhanas, you're going to get enlightened, baby. That's the only four possibilities. That's what we're supposed to do. And so that just cuts across that gomayang of always being afraid of being happy. It depends on what type of happiness. The happiness born of letting go, that is to be followed, pursued, made much of. So, after a while, you get into these peaceful, beautiful meditations. The breath is just delightful. And the delight just gets so strong you can't feel the breath anymore. Just like the body vanishes, so does the breath. And all you're left with is the delight. The simile for that is, so hard to get similes, is Alice through the looking glass. When, I think it's that, or it could be in Wonderland, one of the two. When Alice, which one is it? Through the looking glass. When it meets the Cheshire Cat. She sees this cat appear on a branch of a tree. And a Cheshire Cat is supposed to be a cat with a permanent smile on it. It's just, you know, it's physiognomy, whatever it's called, just the way it's born. It's not really smiling, but it looks like that. So anyway, he sees his Cheshire Cat smiling on a tree. And then the Cheshire Cat suddenly vanishes. Then it appears again. Then it vanishes again. And it says, oh, you just, this is really giving me, I don't know exactly the words, it's really giving me a headache, you know, just all you coming and going so fast. So the Cheshire Cat, quite compassionate, said, okay, I won't do that anymore. This time I will disappear slowly. And so the cat disappears part by part. I think it's only the Cheshire Cat's head, if I remember correctly. But then the ears just vanish. And then the whiskers vanish. And then the fur vanishes. The eyes disappear. The nose disappears. And lastly, the smile disappears. No, the lips disappear, the mouth disappears, leaving only the smile. To which Alice says, for me this was unforgettable, I've often seen a cat without a smile, but this is the first time I've seen a smile without a cat. It's just a good use of English. But afterwards you say, wow, what a great simile that is to what happens in meditation. The smile is left without a person doing the smiling. No beautiful breath, just left the beautiful. So that is a decent, accurate description of what happens. You're sitting there, no breath anymore, but you're really happy. Really delightfully happy. And this is where, again, it's the mind. The mind is now pretty much separated from the body. Not physically, it's not in space floating up. It's just all you're aware of is the mind. Beautiful, happy. Can't feel the body. And at this point, very often, but not always, it's accompanied by what we call the nimittas, the lights. Not always seen as a light. Sometimes people feel it as a sensation, just not real sensation, but it's just like, instead of using the visual sense, it's like the sense of touch. It's nowhere in the body at all, it's just the mind is very happy. Sometimes feel a deep pleasure. Because these are mind objects, and we have, you realize there's so little vocabulary we have for real mind states. All our languages is built from out there in the world and the contact of our senses with that world. When it comes to real mind states, we get lost for words, literally, and even lost for perceptions. So what the mind does, it picks up from its database of memory and perceptions what's closest to this experience you have when the five senses disappear and you get into the close to the realm of the mind. And because most people are visual people, that's why they'll see this mind as an emitter, as a light. It's not a light. Sometimes some people, less likely, feel it as a physical sensation, but it's not located in your body anywhere. And even more rarely, some people experience a smell. So it's happened to quite a few people that you're meditating. You just meditate, you're sitting, you get to such beautiful deep states of mind, and you feel like there's like a fragrant, like jasmine smell or sandalwood. Really strong. You're not imagining it's there. And you know, people don't wear scents or deodorants in this place. And you wonder, you know, no person is wearing this. But you can smell it. And then sometimes, when these things first happened, you know, you thought, oh, this was the devas visiting you. It wasn't devas, it was just your sense of smell. You know, it stopped. But the mind was experiencing this joy through your most attractive smell you've ever had. And so it is just like the world of the mind. So experiencing smell. No one else will be able to smell it. There's no real, what's it called, pheromones or whatever it's called, out there. This is just the mind experiencing the joy through the sense of smell. But it's usually better when it gets to nimittas to use the visual objects because they're much easier to work with. Because we're most used to visual objects. So it happens, and sometimes we have these, and of course the physical feelings, the sounds, the smells, the touches, they could really be out there, but they're not really disturbing you. This is something much more. So then you get these wonderful nimittas coming up. Again, don't be afraid of them. Just don't do anything. The whole meditation is built on doing nothing. Sometimes remember, apparently more people remember this than I really thought. As a kid, I used to play with playing cards, building a house of cards. You know, you put two playing cards together, another two together, and then put one on top, making a bridge, and then put another two on top of that. I don't know if you've ever played those house of cards games, but see how high you can build this house of cards, like a pyramid. And then the higher you get, sometimes you just can't breathe on it, and it's just a slight movement and the whole thing comes crashing down. That was what the game was. You had to be really careful, very still, to get this house of cards very high. And that's similar to the meditation. The higher you get, the less you should do. Otherwise, it just falls apart. So this is what happens. You just watch this beautiful light in the mind. Sometimes it's not just a beautiful light. Sometimes I gave all these things different names. The firework nimitta. Flash, flash, flash. They don't last. And sometimes the sheet nimitta, it's like there's a whole screen there. Not that bright, but you know, it's a light. It's quite nice. Or sometimes there's the complicated nimittas where you see landscapes, beautiful fields of running water. Depends on what you take to be your idyllic paradise. And sometimes you see monsters. The monster nimitta. That came to me once and never again. Sitting down, meditating, really quiet. Getting very peaceful. Instead of that, the beautiful light. Please excuse me for being dramatic, because at the end, towards the end of the talk, people get a bit dull. So it was a monster. His big eyes, like they're almost coming out of the sockets, and red on the outside. And then the hair, this is many years ago, I know this because this was before the punks, had spiky hair and just big bulging eyes, and its mouth was all sort of like vampire fangs all over and dripping red stuff, which must have been blood. And around its neck were shrunken skulls. it was going to be. And I had enough wisdom and insight to say, yeah, I can remember this. This is that picture you see in Buddhist paintings. Like, was it Kali or something? And instead of getting afraid, let's play with this. So over its bulging eyes, which were pretty scary, I put a pair of Elvis Presley Ray-Bans. So it looked really cool, and some dark glasses. Couldn't see its eyes. Above its spiky hair, I put sort of a straw hat with a flower coming out. And its mouth, with all these serrated teeth, really sharp. You know, when I was in school, a naughty kid used to sort of black out a few teeth. And so just I blacked out, so it looked like it really desperately needed to go and see a monster dentist. And a cigarette out of its mouth. And I forget what else I did, but by the time I played around and doodled with the monster, it looked so ridiculous. It looked just so humiliated that it never came back to me again. It vanished. That's how you deal with monsters. Just doodle with them and don't take them seriously. But another time, so some of those, the way you experience things is again what you've just been doing before. Because I've just been to some temple or something and seen these pictures and they're just stuck in my mind. But the opposite part of that, that meditating in my cave a few years ago, and the nimitta I got, I get really peaceful, breath disappearing, this beautiful light came into my mind. It was a very gorgeous yellow, deeper, no, more yellow than yellow. It was just, you know, not the sort of yellow you see in this world. Like you take the best yellow and you scrub it up and make it pure. But it had a shape to it and some black lines. And I recognized it immediately. Garfield. Garfield the cat. I was looking at too many comics in the newspapers. And I never know anyone else, any monk who's ever online who's admitted to getting the Garfield nimitta. That's very rare. Of course, as soon as I saw it. And my samadhi broke right there and then. I just laughed. And that was the end of my meditation session. But it was a real nimitta because, you know, the colours were just incredibly pure and deep. And that's always a good sign of a really big nimitta coming. But anyway, so you have all these nimittas. So what do you do with them? Just leave them alone if you say, I've got to develop them. You know, is this a nimitta? You're disturbing it. Ajahn Chah's saying, still forest pool. Yeah, I'll finish off here because sometimes I go over and then get tied up with interviews. With still forest pool, he used to say that forest monks would go into the jungles, into the forests, and in the evening, walking just by yourself, that you try and find a lake or a river or a pond or a well or somewhere where you could wash your clothes, get some water to drink, set up your mosquito net tent, and then just meditate there in the evening and maybe just go to bed 9, 10 o'clock. But he said that sometimes Ajahn Chah would not meditate. He'd wash, set up his mosquito net 10, 20 meters away from the edge of the water, and sit with his eyes open watching the animals come out in the evening. They wanted to drink as well and wash. He said sometimes he'd be so still the animals would not know he was there. If they detected he was there, they would be more scared of him than he was of them. More animals have been killed by human beings than any human beings being killed by an animal. Bears, tigers, elephants, they were terrified of humans, much more than we are of them, for good reason. And so he'd have to be very still, because the animals, he said, would come out, their eyes weren't that good, but they would sniff and listen. And if they smelt anything strange, or if they heard him move, then they would run away, even though they were really thirsty. But sometimes, he said, it was so quiet, they would come out, couldn't detect him there. And so they come out with their young to play. And of course, these days, apparently have National Geographic, Nature Channel, whatever, and just watching animals play in the wild. They're just delightful. But after the normal animals would come out and play and drink and then go back into the forest, he would wait very calmly, and then he said, these amazing animals would come out. Animals which were so beautiful, and none of his teachers or his parents had ever mentioned that such animals exist, because they were so rare. They were so sensitive. If they detected a human being, they would never come out. But those times it was totally still. Then they'd come out to play. Beautiful, rare animals, the like of which he'd never seen before. Only when he was still. And that was his simile for the nimittas and the jhanas. Real, but very rare. And if you move, if you say, wow, they know, they run away. If you say, yes, then you have to wait for a long time before they come back again. That was such a beautiful simile because I could relate to that. And so when nimittas come up, and then if you know how to be still, practice many times, you'll blow it. But then a time will come when you're so still. Remember that simile. And then they'll come out to play by your mind. Incredible, beautiful lights, first of all. The jhanas will come next. And sometimes, again, this is not seen by your eye. So many people have the experience of think, I'm going to go blind. So intensely brilliant. There's no way that I can see this without going blind afterwards. Because that's what we've been taught. If you stare at the sun, you know, you will go blind. But it's not a visual object. It's a mental object. We interpret it as a visual object, but it's pure mind. It can be as bright as it likes, and you never go blind, obviously. It's just fear. But the other one, which is also, you know, it's when it sort of happened to me years ago, and then every now and again someone comes up and said, oh yeah, you know, this happened to me too. And they mean it. I'm not just faking it. And they come up and say, it's so pleasurable, so incredibly joyful. They think that no human being can take so much bliss. And that's, what a wonderful hindrance that is. The fear that you're going to explode because you can't take so much bliss. And the answer is, you can. There's no limit to the ecstasy you can actually feel in deep meditation. Wow, you monks, meditators, you're just hedonists, that's all you are. Yeah? I admit it. But it has its amazing results afterwards. So imagine that. This is a path if you follow. Bliss upon bliss upon bliss. It's real. With no bad side effects. Except, there is one bad side effect. I have to be really honest with you and say, people ask me, is there any dangers in this? And say, yes, there is, actually. The danger in all this is that you do tend to lose your hair. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay. Very good. So now is the time for the interviews. So please forgive me if I'm going to get strict today to keep it to 10 minutes, because yesterday some of the people at the very end, I had to sort of reschedule them for the afternoon because there was no time. So please, 10 minutes. So you can get your questions in order and then we can see.